Part 3. Master Coaching. Chapter 8. The Talent Whisperers. It's not about recognizing talent, whatever the hell that is. I've never tried to go out and find someone who's talented. First, you work on fundamentals, and pretty soon, you find out where things are going. Robert Lansdorp, tennis coach of former world number one players Pete Sampras, Tracy Austin and Lindsay Davenport, all of whom grew up within a few miles of each other in Los Angeles. The ESP of Hans Jensen. In the early part of the 20th century, American bank robbers weren't very skilled. Gangs like the Newton Brothers of Texas followed a simple and unvarying plan. They picked a bank, waited until nightfall, then blew open the vault with dynamite and or nitroglycerin, which, in addition to being ticklish to handle, occasionally had the unfortunate side effect of setting the money on fire. This straightforward approach worked well for a time, but by the early 1920s the banks had caught up, introducing alarm systems and concrete-reinforced blast-proof vaults. Gangs like the Newtons were stymied. Bank authorities expected that a new era of safety and security had dawned. It didn't dawn. The bank robbers simply became more skilled. These new thieves worked in daylight and operated with such clockwork professionalism that even the police were occasionally moved to admiration. It was as if bank robbers had suddenly evolved into a more talented species. They demonstrated their capabilities in downtown Denver on December the 19th, 1922, when a gang relieved the Federal Mint of $200,000 in 90 seconds flat, a feat that then ranked, on a per-second basis, among history's most lucrative bank heists. This evolution could be traced to the man who led that Denver gang, Herman the Baron Lamb. Lamb was the originator and teacher of modern bank-robbing skill. Born in Germany around 1880, Lamb rose to become an officer in the Prussian army. Expelled from the army, allegedly for cheating at cards, he emigrated to the United States, where he took up a semi-successful career as a hold-up man, robbing people, and occasionally banks. In 1917, while serving a two-year stint in Utah State Prison, Lamb conceived of a new system of bank robbery, applying military principles to what had been an artless profession. His singular insight was that robbing banks was not about guts or guns. It was about technique. Each bank job involved weeks of preparatory work. Lamb pioneered casing, which meant visiting the bank, sketching blueprint-like maps, and occasionally posing as a journalist to get a look at the bank's interior operations. Lamb assigned each man on his team a well-defined role: lookout, lobby man, vault man, driver. He organized rehearsals, using warehouses to stand in for the bank. He insisted on unyielding obedience to the clock. When the allotted time expired, the gang would depart, whether or not they had the money. Lamb scouted the getaway route in different weather conditions to gauge time. He taped maps to the dashboard that were indexed to the tenth of a mile. Lamb's system, dubbed the Baron Lamb technique, worked well. From 1919 to 1930, it brought Lamb hundreds of thousands of dollars from banks around the country. After his death, it was taught to John Dillinger, among others. Lamb died in 1930 when he encountered a series of events so improbable that even he could not have anticipated them. He was departing a bank in Clinton, Indiana, when the getaway car blew a tire. Lamb and three members of his gang commandeered another car, but it was equipped with a governor that prevented it from going faster than 35 miles an hour. They commandeered a third, but it suffered a radiator leak. They commandeered a fourth, but its tank contained only a gallon of gas. After a short chase and the surrender of two gang members, the doubtlessly incredulous Lamb and his driver were shot to death by police. Lamb's system, still employed today, succeeded not only because of its conceptual strength, but also because Lamb was able to communicate his ideas and translate them into the seamless performance of an immensely difficult task. He was an innovator who taught with discipline and exactitude. He inspired through information. In short, Baron Lamb was a master coach. So far in this book, we've talked about skill as a cellular process that grows through deep practice. We've seen how ignition supplies the unconscious energy for that growth. Now it's time to meet the rare people who have the uncanny knack for combining those forces to grow talent in others. Before we find out who the master coaches are, however, let's find out who they aren't. When most of us think of a master coach, we think of a great leader, a person of steadfast vision, battle-tested savvy, and commanding eloquence. Like a ship's captain or a preacher on the pulpit, their core ability lies in knowing a special something that the rest of us don't, and sharing that special knowledge with us in a motivating way. In this way of thinking, the skills of legendary football coach Vince Lombardi are not appreciably different from those of General George Patton or Queen Elizabeth I. But when I visited the talent hotbeds, I didn't find many Lombardis or Pattons, or Queen Elizabeths for that matter. Instead, the teachers and coaches I met were quiet, even reserved. They were mostly older. Many had been teaching 30 or 40 years. They possessed the same sort of gaze, steady, deep, unblinking. They listened far more than they talked. They seemed allergic to giving pep talks or inspiring speeches. They spent most of their time offering small, targeted, highly specific adjustments. They had an extraordinary sensitivity to the person they were teaching, customizing each message to each student's personality. After meeting a dozen of these people, I started to suspect that they were all secretly related. They were talent whisperers. They were people like Hans Jensen. Hans Jensen is a cello teacher who lives in Chicago. I met him at Meadowmount Music School, that remote haven of classical talent in the Adirondacks we visited earlier in the book. I had never heard of Jensen, but here, even amidst an all-star faculty, he was regarded as special. During my first morning at Meadowmount, two students mentioned how their families had relocated to Chicago so they could take lessons from Jensen. Melissa Kraut, who teaches at the Cleveland Institute of Music, simply described him as the most brilliant cello teacher on the planet. Jensen turned out to be a rangy, ebullient, 50-ish Dane with large round glasses, from behind which he regarded the world with the voracious gaze of a scuba diver. When I found him in one of Meadowmount's practice cabins, that gaze was aimed at 18-year-old Sang Yi, who was playing a Dvorak concerto. To my ear, Sang's playing was miraculous, fast, clean, note-perfect. But Jensen was not satisfied. He stood a few inches away as the student played, waving his arms and talking to Sang in his thick Danish accent. It looked as if Jensen were performing some kind of exorcism. "Now! Now!" he shouted. "There is only now! You've got to go, wah! Like a turbine. You've got to do it, man, and you've got to do it now!" Sang played furiously, his hand flashing up and down the neck of the cello. Jensen leaned in closer. "I see it in your eyes. You say, 'Oh, crap, I have to do it.' So don't think." Pronounced "think" in Jensen's accent. "Do it now!" Sang closed his eyes and play. "Ya, ya!" Jensen shouted. "Go, go!" Sang ended the piece and leaned back woozily, as if he had just stepped off a carnival ride. "There," Jensen said. "That is where you have to go with this." Sang thanked Jensen, packed up his cello, and departed as Whitney Delfos, the next student, stepped forward. Delfos was 20 years old, from Houston, and wore a pink Lacoste shirt with the collar turned up. She had arrived in time to see the end of Sang's lesson, and now took her seat, grasping the neck of her instrument, sweating lightly. Jensen put her at ease, leaning back in his chair, smiling broadly. "Howdy," he said disarmingly. Delfos smiled and seemed to relax a little. Jensen asked her to play, and he listened quietly as she dove into a Bach concerto. Delfos was shakier than Sang. She smudged a few notes, lost the rhythm of a fast passage, and generally seemed to be wrestling with the instrument. She glanced warily at Jensen as she played, expecting him to launch into another arm-waving, shouting exhibition as he had with Sang. But Jensen didn't. After 30 seconds, he placed a gentle hand on her bow, stilling it. He leaned in, as if he were about to whisper a state secret. "You must sink it," he said.
"Sink it?"
Delphos was mystified. Jensen tapped his bald head, and she understood. "Sink," he repeated. "Sink the whole piece. When you sink it, it is 10 times better. People practice too much moving the bow. You must practice up here." He pointed again to his head. "You must sink. This is the vitamin. It doesn't taste good, but it's good for you." Delphos set down her bow, closed her eyes, and, as instructed, imagined her way through sections of her concerto. When she was finished, her eyes open again, Jensen said, "You used vibrato when you imagined playing that last section, didn't you?" Delphos's jaw dropped.
"How did you know?"
Jensen smiled. "I sometimes freak people out," he said. "They think I have ESP. Jensen has a long list of professional qualifications. He studied at Juilliard with renowned teachers Leonard Rose and Channing Robbins. He soloed with the Copenhagen Symphony and won the Artist International competition. His knowledge of classical cello music is second to none. But what we're seeing here has nothing to do with Jensen's qualifications, and everything to do with his mysterious ESP, specifically his skill at sensing the student's needs and instantly producing the right signal to meet those needs. Jensen did not know Sang and Delphos before they stepped into the room. He didn't need to. The examination, diagnosis, and prescription all happened within seconds. Sang needed more emotion, so Jensen turned into a hepped-up cheerleader. Delphos needed a learning strategy, so Jensen turned into a Zen master. He didn't only tell them what to do, he became what they should do, communicating the goal with gesture, tone, rhythm, and gaze. The signals were targeted, concise, unmissable, and accurate. After Jensen was finished teaching Sang and Delphos, I asked him for his professional opinion of the two students. Which was more talented? Which had more potential? Jensen seemed to struggle with the question, which surprised me. Sang seemed better than Delphos by a decent margin, but the planet's best cello teacher didn't see things the same way I did. "It's difficult to say," Jensen said evenly. "When I teach, I give everyone everything. What happens after that, who can know?" This sentiment, even-keeled, prudent, unromantic, had a familiar ring. Many of the talent whisperers reminded me of my relatives in Illinois farming towns, who were tough, unsurprisable, and circumspect. They could talk for hours about the tiniest details of seeds or fertilizers, but when it came to the larger questions, the quality of the upcoming harvest, the playoff chances of their beloved St. Louis Cardinals baseball team, they shrugged. Who can know? Master coaches aren't like heads of state. They aren't like captains who steer us across the unmarked sea, or preachers on a pulpit ringing out the good news. Their personality, their core skill circuit, is to be more like farmers, careful, deliberate, cultivators of myelin, like Hans Jensen. They're down to earth and disciplined. They possess vast, deep frameworks of knowledge, which they apply to the steady, incremental work of growing skill circuits, which they ultimately don't control. Jensen couldn't answer my question because, at its heart, the question didn't make sense. Is it possible to look at 2 seedlings and tell which will grow taller? The only answer is, it's early, and they're both growing. The Wizard's Secret. In 1970, 2 educational psychologists named Ron Gallimore and Roland Tharp were given a dream opportunity to set up, from scratch, an experimental reading program at a laboratory school in a poor neighborhood in Honolulu. The project, which was funded by a Hawaiian educational foundation, involved 120 K-3 students and was dubbed the Kamehameha Early Education Project, or KEEP, KEEP. Starting in 1972, When the school's doors opened, Gallimore and Tharp applied the most cutting-edge pedagogical theories of the day, many of which had to do with teacher strategies to increase the percentage of on-task time. Gallimore and Tharp were innovative, hard-working, and determined. They also weren't very successful. For the first 2 years, reading achievement at Keep remained low. By the summer of 1974, Gallimore recalled, "We were starting to seriously question our methodology." That summer happened to find both Gallimore and Tharp at UCLA, where they taught a few classes and puzzled over their stalled-out project. One afternoon, while shooting baskets in Gallimore's backyard, Gallimore had an idea. They would perform a detailed, up-close case study of the greatest teacher they could find and use the results to help them at Keep. Both men instantly thought of the same teacher, who happened to be right on UCLA's campus. Yet they hesitated. This particular teacher was so brilliant and acclaimed that to ask him to be a lab rat in a study seemed unthinkable, if not insolent. But Gallimore and Tharp, with nothing to lose, decided to write the famous teacher anyway. They mailed their request to his office in Pawley Pavilion, addressed to Mr. John Wooden, head basketball coach. To describe John Wooden as a good basketball coach is like describing Abraham Lincoln as a solid congressman. The Wizard of Westwood, as Wooden was known, was a former English teacher from small-town Indiana who quoted Wordsworth and lived Christian values of discipline, morality, and teamwork. He had led UCLA to 9 national championships in the previous 10 years. His team had recently concluded an 88-game undefeated stretch that had lasted for nearly 3 years. One of the many historic feats that would later lead ESPN to name Wooden the greatest coach of all time in any sport. As Gallimore and Tharp were well aware, Wooden had no earthly reason to submit himself to the prying of a couple of nosy scientists, so they were more than a little surprised when Wooden's answer arrived. Yes. A few weeks later, Gallimore and Tharp settled eagerly into courtside seats at Pawley Pavilion to watch Wooden coach the season's first practice. As fans of the team, as well as former athletes themselves, they knew what to expect. Chalk talks, inspiring speeches, punishment laps for slackers, praise for hard workers. Then practice began. Wooden didn't give speeches. He didn't do chalk talks. He didn't dole out punishment laps or praise. In all, he didn't sound or act like any coach they'd ever encountered. "We thought we knew what coaching was," Gallimore said. "Our expectations were completely wrong. Completely. All the stuff I'd associated with coaching. There was none of it." Wooden ran an intense whirligig of 5 to 15 minute drills, issuing a rapid-fire stream of words all the while. The interesting part was the content of those words. As their subsequent article, Basketball's John Wooden, What a Coach Can Teach a Teacher, put it, Wooden's teaching utterances or comments were short, punctuated, and numerous. There were no lectures, no extended harangues. He rarely spoke longer than 20 seconds. Here are some of Wooden's more long-winded speeches. "Take the ball softly. You're receiving a pass, not intercepting it. Do some dribbling between shots. Crisp passes, really snap them. Good, Richard. That's just what I want. Hard, driving, quick steps." Gallimore and Tharp were confused. They'd expected to find a basketball Moses intoning sermons from the Mount, yet this man resembled a busy telegraph operator. They felt slightly deflated. This was great coaching? Gallimore and Tharp kept attending practices. As weeks and months went by, an ember of insight began to glow. It came partly from watching the team improve, rising from third in the conference at mid-season to winning its 10th national championship. But it came mostly from the data they collected in their notebooks. Gallimore and Tharp recorded and coded 2,326 discrete acts of teaching. Of them, a mere 6.9% were compliments. Only 6.6%, were expressions of displeasure. But 75% were pure information. What to do, how to do it, when to intensify an activity. One of Wooden's most frequent forms of teaching was a three-part instruction where he modelled the right way to do something, showed the incorrect way, and then remodelled the right way, a sequence that appeared in Gallimore and Tharp's notes as M+, M-, M+. It happened so often they named it a Wooden. As Gallimore and Tharp wrote, Wooden's demonstrations rarely take longer than 3 seconds, but are of such clarity that they leave an image in memory, much like a textbook sketch. The information didn't slow down the practice. To the contrary, Wooden combined it with something he called mental and emotional conditioning, which basically amounted to everyone running harder than they did in games all the time. As former player Bill Walton said, practices at UCLA were non-stop, electric, supercharged, intense, demanding. While Wooden's practices looked natural and unplanned, in fact, they were anything but. The coach would spend 2 hours each morning with his assistants planning that day's practice, then write out the minute-by-minute schedule on 3x5 cards. He kept cards from year to year so he could compare and adjust. No detail was too small to be considered. Wooden famously began each year by showing players how to put on their socks to minimise the chance of blisters. What looked like a flowing, improvised series of drills was in fact as well-structured as a libretto. What looked like Wooden shooting from the hip was in fact closer to planned talking points. As Gallimore and Tharp wrote, Wooden made decisions on the fly, at a pace equal to his players, in response to the details of his players' actions. Yet his teaching was in no sense ad hoc. Down to the specific words he used, his planning included specific goals both for the team and for individuals. Thus, he could pack into a practice a rich basketball curriculum and deliver information at precisely the moments it would help his students learn the most. Gradually, a picture came into focus. What made Wooden a great coach wasn't praise, wasn't denunciation, and certainly wasn't pep talks. His skill resided in the Gatling gun rattle of targeted information he fired at his players. This, not that. Here, not there. His words and gestures served as short, sharp impulses that showed his players the correct way to do something. He was seeing and fixing errors. He was honing circuits. He was a virtuoso of deep practice, a one-man link trainer. Wooden may not have known about myelin, but like all master coaches, he had a deep understanding of how it worked. He taught in chunks, using what he called the whole part method. He would teach players an entire move, then break it down to work on its elemental actions. He formulated laws of learning, which might be retitled laws of myelin, explanation, demonstration, imitation, correction, and repetition. Don't look for the big, quick improvement. Seek the small improvement one day at a time. That's the only way it happens, and when it happens, it lasts, he wrote in The Wisdom of Wooden. The importance of repetition until automaticity cannot be overstated, he said, in You Haven't Taught Until They Have Learned, authored by Gallimore and former Wooden player Sven Nater. Repetition is the key to learning. Most people regard Wooden's success as a product of his humble, thoughtful, inspiring character. But Gallimore and Tharp showed that his success was a result less of his character than of his error-centered, well-planned, information-rich practices. In fact, it was Wooden's commitment to this method of learning that led him to agree to participate in Gallimore and Tharp's experiment in the first place. As Wooden later explained, he had hoped to use the experience to improve shortcomings in his coaching. The wizard's secret, it turned out, was the same secret that the Renaissance artists and the Z-Boys discovered. The deeper you practice, the better you get. Gallimore and Tharp returned to Keep that fall and began to apply what they'd learned, placing a new focus on lesson planning and information-oriented teaching. They combined praise with wouldn'ts. They demonstrated and explained. They spoke in short, imperative bursts. They also added other new research, including a mix of cultural-based approaches. We refocused our work, Gallimore said. We started approaching the school with the idea of, what would John Wooden do? Slowly, steadily, KEEP began to take off. Reading scores rose, comprehension improved, and the school, which had previously lagged far behind national averages in standardized test scores, was soon exceeding them by a healthy margin. In 1993, Gallimore and Tharp's KEEP project received the Graumeier Award, one of education's highest honors. Their success was chronicled in their book, Rousing Minds to Life. It's not so simple as to say John Wooden made the school work. There were lots of dimensions to this, Gallimore said, but he does deserve a lot of the credit. Even as we point out Wooden's coaching brilliance, however, it's important to note that he was hardly operating under average circumstances. His players arrived at UCLA with high degrees of skill and motivation. He had vast resources on which to draw. But what about coaches and teachers who live in the normal world? What kind of coaching works best in situations where students are starting out, where they haven't been selected for any special ability, where the circuitry doesn't yet exist? Or, to put the question in terms that matter around our house, what makes for a good piano teacher? Coaching love. It's the most basic common sense. If you want to start a child in a new skill, you should search out the best trained, most John Wooden-like teacher possible. Right? Not necessarily. In the early 1980s, a University of Chicago team of researchers led by Dr. Benjamin Bloom undertook a study of 120 world-class pianists, swimmers, tennis champions, mathematicians, neurologists, and sculptors. Bloom's team examined each along a range of dimensions, among which was their initial education in their chosen field. They discovered a surprising fact. Many world-class talents, particularly in piano, swimming, and tennis, started out with seemingly average teachers. For instance, Bloom's researchers asked the piano virtuosos to rate their first teacher as very good, defined as a highly regarded professional instructor with extensive training, better than average, a teacher with good training and more musical knowledge than a local neighborhood teacher, or average, a non-professional neighborhood teacher. Of the 21 internationally accomplished pianists in the study, only two had a first teacher who qualified as very good. The majority had teachers who qualified as average, 62%, or better than average, 24%. The pattern held in swimming and tennis. The neurologists and mathematicians typically received their first training in school, which wasn't subject to the same variable of teacher choice, while the sculptors had not been guided by early instruction of any kind. One might suspect that the average teacher was quickly replaced with someone more skilled, but that didn't seem to be the case. Bloom's pianists, for instance, had typically stayed with the first teacher for 5 or 6 years. From a scientific perspective, it was as if the researchers had traced the lineage of the world's most beautiful swans back to a scruffy flock of barnyard chickens. As the study concisely put it, the initial teachers were largely determined by the chances of proximity and availability. Chance? But aren't Wooden, Jensen, Preobrazhenskaya, and the other talent whisperers successful because their skills represent the precise opposite of chance? At first glance, Bloom's study would seem to suggest that top-flight talent is an innate genetic gift that transcends teaching. But perhaps something else is going on here. As it happens, the town in which our family lives, population 5,000, is a bit of a musical hotbed. Long winters don't hurt. There are several top-flight teachers with impressive degrees from top institutions and a spanking new music school. But when my wife and I decided to start our kids at piano lessons, we were directed towards someone we didn't expect, a little old lady who taught in a rickety house built around a trailer that stands next to a creek. Her name is Mary Epperson. Mary Epperson is 86 years old and 4 feet 6 inches tall. She has thick white hair and keen dark eyes that seem custom-built to express curiosity and wonderment. Her voice is musical, able to stretch single words into brief songs of delight or conspiratorial whispers. She does not engage in small talk, but rather holds previous conversations in her mind like so many threads, which she operates with sharp tugs. She begins most conversations with the phrase, "Now tell me." If you are a child visiting Miss Mary for a lesson, this is what happens. First, she is extremely pleased to see you. She lights up like a Christmas tree. You talk a while about what's happening in your life and hers. She remembers all of it, of course, the camping trip, the English test, the new bike. She nods gravely at the serious points, laughs at the funny ones. She regards children as miniature adults and doesn't shy away from pointed truths. Once, Miss Mary asked my father if he ever played an instrument. He said he had tried piano, but didn't have the knack. "Didn't have the patience, you mean," Miss Mary replied kindly, but firmly. The lesson begins. By most measures, it's the usual routine. Songs are played, mistakes are made, improvements are suggested, stickers are pasted to tops of pages. But on a deeper level, something entirely different is happening. Each interaction vibrates with Miss Mary's interest and emotion. To have better hand position is to earn a thrilling jolt of praise. To play something incorrectly brings a regretful, "I'm sorry," and a request to please play it again, and again, and perhaps again. To play something properly brings a warm gust of joy. When it's over, there's a foil-wrapped chocolate. Then you bow and say, "Thank you for teaching," and Miss Mary bows and solemnly replies, "Thank you for learning." I thought of Miss Mary when I read the descriptions of the so-called average first piano teachers in Bloom's study. She was really great with young kids. She was very kindly, very nice. She liked young people, and she was very nice, and he liked her. He was very good with kids, liked kids instinctively, and had a good rapport. He was enormously patient and not very pushy. She carried a big basket of Hershey bars and gold stars for the music, and I was crazy about this lady. It was an event for me to go to my lessons. These people are not average teachers. Neither is Mary Epperson. As Bloom and his researchers realized, they're merely disguised as average because their crucial skill does not show up on conventional measures of teaching ability. They succeed because they are tapping into the second element of the talent code, ignition. They are creating and sustaining motivation. They are teaching love. As Bloom's study summed up, the effect of this first phase of learning seemed to be to get the learner involved, captivated, hooked, and to get the learner to need and want more information and expertise. It is not easy to love playing the piano. It has lots of keys, and a child has lots of fingers, and there are an infinite number of mistakes that can be made. Yet certain teachers have the rare ability to make it desirable and fun. As Bloom's study put it, perhaps the major quality of these teachers was that they made the initial learning very pleasant and rewarding. Much of the introduction to the field was as playful activity, and the learning at the beginning of this stage was much like a game. These teachers gave much positive reinforcement and only rarely were critical of the child. However, they did set standards and expected the child to make progress, although this was largely done with approval and praise. If Gallimore and Tharp were to conduct a study inside Miss Mary's tiny studio, they would find a stream of cues rich enough to rival those given on the poorly pavilioned basketball court. This is not an accident. John Wooden uses the deep practice part of the talent mechanism, speaking the language of information and correction, honing circuitry. Miss Mary, on the other hand, deals in matters of ignition, using emotional triggers to fill fuel tanks with love and motivation. They succeed because building myelin circuits requires both deep practice and ignition. They succeed because they are mirrors of the talent code itself. Yet, while myelin may be counted in reps and hours, Wooden and Miss Mary also show us that master coaching is something more evanescent, more art than science. It exists in the space between two people, in the warm, messy game of language, gesture, and expression. To better understand how this process works, let's pull back and take a broader look at the shared characteristics of master coaches.